from the Mutual Broadcasting System. This is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Well, welcome to STRAT, and I've got a lot of different things I'm going to talk about today. It is just me today, although I'm going to have a guest on either the next weekend or the weekend after. I'm going to have a guest on and talk about a variety of things. But today I'm going to talk about some key issues. I'm going to talk about some things tied to war, tied to global conflict. But you may say, okay, you're going to talk about tariffs, so that has to do with international trade. Not exactly. I kind of go with the Chinese doctrine of unrestricted warfare. And I was recently on a news interview, and we were talking about warfare. And I said, we have to be careful about mirror imaging how we view the world with onto other places in the world, Russia and China. And I mentioned Chinese military doctrine or war doctrine or conflict doctrine or just doctrine called unrestricted warfare, whereas they don't see commercial things, financial things as completely separate from war fighting. They just see it as kind of a gradual thing or different gradations or levels or application of the same general idea. Kind of going back to Sun Tzu with the, that a superior general certainly tries to win a war without actually having to fight the war. Well, it's that sort of same concept. So anyway, I'm going to talk about this because I kind of see it as all part of the same greater thing. So let's talk about tariffs and war. And one thing I want to specifically focus on, and this is kind of a microcosm, is something that's happening in the Senate. There is a majority of U.S. senators, this is bipartisan, that support a 500% tariff on Russian energy going to those countries. Now, this is what we call reciprocal tariff. So, in other words, if China imports Russian oil, they get a 500% tariff affixed to what they did. In essence, and the way it sounds right now, it's pretty much an embargo. So, it puts China, India, Iran, some other countries in a very difficult position, which is either they quit importing Russian oil, or they're going to, and for some that may include liquefied natural gas, or they're going to have to face this massive tariff regime with the United States. And for China and India, it hits a lot harder than Iran, obviously, but it hits everywhere where this is going on. And by the way, there's a number of countries around the world that have been importing Russian oil at this discount price because Russia is desperate to sell oil, gas, wherever they can. In fact, I don't know if they're still doing it, but Saudi Arabia, at the beginning of the war, about the first, second year of the war in Ukraine, was buying up Russian oil at a discount price, and then they were storing it and then reselling it at a higher price. I mean, it was a quick way to make a fast buck. And I don't know if they're still doing that, but they were doing that. Well, what this will do is, if it's imposed, and certainly if it's enforced, it's going to knock a lot of countries out of the Russian energy import business because of its potential impact. It is rather amazing. Senator Lindsey Graham is spearheading this bipartisan effort to get this legislation passed. And it would just have a phenomenal impact across the board with a number of different countries. It'd be interesting. It'd actually make the world's oceans and waterways a lot safer because this dark tanker fleet, as they call it, these are Russian tankers that will go to sea. Some of them are not particularly, they're not well-maintained. They're not particularly seaworthy tankers. They're not well-crewed. They don't have great masters of those vessels in charge. And they turn off their automated identification system, AIS, a safety thing whereby other ships and the countries that they're sailing by can track where they are. So, gee, what could possibly go wrong, particularly in tight, congested waterways around the world? So you can imagine that's been an ongoing threat. There have been incidents, nothing truly catastrophic per se, although some might disagree with me on that. but it's just been rolling the dice, particularly in areas like the Baltic and places like that. A lot of concern about what could happen. So it would make the waterway safer if this was to happen. It's not clear if President Trump would want to sign something this powerful, if you will, aimed at the Kremlin. You know, he is, although it does appear his thinking about Putin, his thinking about his relationship with Putin, his thinking about what Putin's intent and veracity is in terms of discussions had with them has been evolving and changing. And he's been saying some things that make it indicate that he doesn't think Putin is at all sincere about trying to end the war. In fact, he even indicated that I think he was saying tapping me along, meaning basically playing him in so many words, playing for time with all the different things that Russia's been saying on this. So that's been changing, and there seems to be a consensus building in Washington, D.C., particularly in the White House, that the only thing that Putin will ever hear is strong action by the United States. So this may end up going to the White House and potentially even getting signed if it comes from Congress. It's also not entirely clear. I've heard a lot of discussion that they're pretty sure they have a majority in the House that can do this, but they were kind of doing a lot of constellation work in both chambers to see if they had a veto-proof majority. In other words, did they have enough members that if President Trump was to veto it, could they override his veto? And now, of course, with the White House making it very clear that we're basically, you know, the first 100 days is done, and it was pretty much being said that if they didn't have some sort of agreement in place with 100 days, that the U.S. is going to pull back from the negotiations, pull back from trying to be a mediator in negotiations between Russia and Ukraine. Well, now it appears that is completely underway, and we are pulling back. Now, there's a couple different scenarios, and everyone is kind of concerned, what does pull back mean? Well, you may recall earlier that pull back for the U.S. was we pulled back intelligence sharing and we stopped all aid going to Ukraine. And that obviously got a lot of people very concerned about where we were going and certainly playing into Putin's hands on that one. That was resolved, and that was in order to get that, you know, among other things, to get Ukraine to say, yes, we want to do a ceasefire, and then also to get the minerals agreement put in place. Well, the minerals agreement is now signed, and it's a very different agreement than what was on the table in February. In fact, the minerals agreement now is an agreement that looks actually pretty good for both parties. It's kind of a win-win for both Ukraine and the U.S., and it makes the U.S. a stakeholder in a stable, secure Ukraine, because you can't pull any minerals or any natural resources out of Ukraine unless you have a stable environment, a safe environment, an assured environment. You know, this gets into risk assessment, strategic risk assessment. I'm not going to invest money in building a big mining operation in the Ukraine if I think the Russians are going to roll in a year or two and take the place over. So it makes the U.S. a stakeholder. They basically, we've got to figure out a way to stabilize the situation and make it secure in order to actually get anything out of that agreement. So that's in place already. And so that's moving. All right. So the situation has changed a lot. And so I do think that there's a possibility that this may actually come into place. The impact on countries like China and India, if this is put in place, will be obviously enormous. But what's interesting, there will also be impact on the European Union and Europe at large. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that because there's something going on with Europe, which I just find fascinating in terms of balance of trade, if you will, between Europe. It's an initiative by the European Union. And I find it very interesting because it hits on a couple different levels, and I'm going to talk about that. But obviously, Europe would be concerned because they do get Russian natural gas. They may want to offset getting that gas, sourcing it from somewhere else. And I think that's what's happening right now, but I'm going to talk more about that in a bit. Now, the U.S. imposed sanction on Russia after the 2014 Little Green Men invasion, if you will, of the Donbass, and where they basically just took over a Crimea with this not-so-covert invasion, if you will. So that's already happened, all right? Sanctions have been targeted against individuals, They've been targeted against individuals and entities that support the war. They've aimed at banks, exporters. They've obviously tried to stop the export of technology, including dual-use technology that can be used by Russia's war effort, along with aiming at stopping investment in Russia and basically the energy sectors that Russia relies upon. This legislation would continue in that same way. All right. By the way, it also talks about uranium, which is interesting. Russia is a big source of uranium. So it's also talking about massive reciprocal impact with that market as well. So it's interesting to see how this is going to work in concert with all of the other sanctions that have been put in place. Russia, before I think the 2022 invasion, as I recall, was Russia provided about 15% of the oil that went to China. At that time, they were providing about 3% of the oil that was going to India. Although that might be higher now, because I know India was buying up some of this discount Russian oil left and right. So that percentage might be higher. But those countries would want to obviously stop that, because they don't want to see those 500% reciprocal tariffs imposed upon them as well, particularly as both countries are very much involved with negotiating with the U.S. to get the current tariffs brought down. Last thing they want to do is invite massive tariffs. So, and for certain countries, U.S. allies, for example, with Saudi Arabia, they may be tapped with trying to fill the void. And so Saudi Arabia may want to increase production. Other Gulf states may want to increase production. Indonesia may want to increase production. I can think of a number of countries around the world, not the least of which is the United States and Canada, would want to increase production to help fill the void of this demand that would be put in place, or you know, this new demand that would be put in place when the Russian oil becomes and gas becomes completely unavailable. It'll also incentivize countries that are importing Russian uranium to find other sources of uranium. Again, that could impact key U.S. allies and potentially impact the United States as being a provider of uranium, although I think we're going to have to kind of ramp that up a bit because we haven't been doing the uranium mining like we used to. So there's a lot of work to be done there. All right. So a lot of there. Now, here's something else that's going on. The European Union has put forward a deal for European Union buying $1 billion U.S. liquefied natural gas. This is fascinating. By the way, there's another fascinating piece of this too, because if you actually look at the pipelines in the United States, this is going to be something that I think that President Trump's going to have an interesting discussion with the new Prime Minister of Canada. Those pipelines actually run through Canada to get that some of that natural gas out. So that's going to be an interesting discussion, all right, because there has to be a lot of U.S.-Canadian cooperation in order to pull this off, getting that much more liquefied natural gas out the door on ships heading over to Europe. So that may change what's happening in North America to a certain effect because of that, just that one aspect of it. All right. And this is driven by, of course, Europe, the EU, desire to phase out Russian natural gas imports. And of course, like I say, in the background, trying to meet the climate goals that go with some of the other green initiatives that they've had. But basically, most of it's to deal with the war in Ukraine and try and de-link European demand from Russian supply in terms of natural gas. Now, European Union's LNG imports accounted for about 43% of its total natural gas imports in 2023, making it very clear that this is a pretty big part of how Europe powers itself. By the way, natural gas burns a lot cleaner than other things. They've been phased out pretty much almost all the coal stuff, as I recall, over in Europe. So natural gas has been a quick, easy alternative. And I would point to those who have said for a long time that they should have focused on natural gas for quite a while. And so that's a really big thing. All right. Now, what's interesting is if you look at the delta, if you will, and the tariff numbers, and I kind of go back, the little numeric equation that President Trump threw out there to talk about trade deficits with percentages actually wasn't so much trade deficits. That was actually looking, it was a mathematical equation where they were looking at, well, I mean, it was supposed to be looking at tariffs, but it actually looked at trade deficits. It was a little mathematical equation with trade deficits and trying to say this is what the tariff is. And mathematically, well, in terms of definition, it just didn't do that. And a lot of people brought up that that's really interesting, which is what was thrown up on the board, but that isn't actually tariffs. That's something else. Now, with that said, I'm a graduate from a school called Thunderbird. In all modesty, the number one ranked international business graduate school in the country for many, many years. I don't know if it's still number one, but it was certainly forever and ever. And in that, part of what we do is we go through a lot of, graduate classes, if you will, and we look at tariff schedules and we look at non-tariff barriers. We look at taxation. We look at fees. We look at everything to try and figure out where you produce what in what country, where you want to realize certain profits in order to minimize what you're going to pay in tariffs and also in taxes and anything else associated with that country. And of course, you also look at all the cost of goods sold, which, gets into labor, land, energy, infrastructure, you name it. That's kind of what that whole business is. That's what supply chain 101 is. That's what international business is. So when I say tariffs, I just want to say right off, tariffs is only one piece of the equation. All right. It really depends. It's like it's a tariff on shoes. Well, it depends on how you value those shoes once they hit that country. And yes, there are countries that will dump products in the U.S. and they'll dump products elsewhere in order to pay a smaller tariff. And then that money comes into the country. And there's a variety of different ways that original sourcing country of those shoes may actually be selling those shoes at a loss when it comes in to pay the tariffs, but they will have a lot of other ways that somehow that profit, if you will, from selling those shoes retail gets back to them. So there's just a lot of different things. So when I say that wasn't a accurate way of measuring tariffs, which it was not, it did kind of in a sort of broad-based way, if you will, discuss, kind of incorporate some of these non-tariff issues that actually get into why we have trade deficits with different countries. The other thing, too, is these trade deficits that was being cited by the White House were on goods. And as we all know, there are goods and then there are services. The U.S. is actually a very efficient, very effective model for selling services around the world. I've been part of that market. I have traveled to foreign countries and I have sold services like in strategic wargaming and strategy development and all sorts of stuff. I am in the service stuff and I've done it for major corporations. I've done service stuff working with the U.S. government where we go to countries and do stuff and work with those countries. I've done a lot of different things in the service area, and that is actually an area where the U.S. does very well. So there is, with Europe, for example, we have a trade surplus in selling services. We have a trade deficit in goods, all right? If you take the number for the goods sold deficit and you factor that against the trade surplus in services that we have with Europe, interestingly, that almost comes out to equal $56 billion. Which is, it's within a few billion dollars, give or take. And so if the LNG thing comes through, if Europe, the European Union puts that in place, it could be interpreted that we have balanced the trade deficit. There is no trade deficit with Europe. For all I know, they could end up showing, a very small trade surplus if we factor in services. The difference would be that the Trump administration would have to start factoring in trade surplus, at least in citing the European example, if they want to take that and say, look, here's a victory of our tariff policy. We balanced the trade with Europe. We no longer have a deficit in trade with Europe, which would be a heck of a political statement to make. Talk about a fast-paced, immediate return on investment, if you will, or a return on a policy, if you will, if they were to say that. But they had to factor in our trade surplus in terms of services sent to Europe in order to make that claim, and which they might be inclined to do. I can think of a lot of political reasons why they would want to claim a victory in that regard. That would make a lot of sense. Now, if they do it for Europe, do they do it with the rest of the world? That's a good question. And I think if you got to do it with one big area called Europe, you're probably going to have to look at other places like Latin America, Central America, South America, Asia, Africa, the Middle East. You're going to have to look elsewhere around the world. And in most of those places, we do have a trade surplus in services. That would change things. It would change our equation with India. It would change, dramatically change our equation with China across the board. I personally don't do, I don't do anything in China for that regard. Although China is great for my business because I work with other countries that are dealing with China. But I have friends that, you know, go and work with companies and stuff in China. China is a big producer of U.S. goods and they provide services to help those companies. And so there is a lot of U.S. service trade that goes to China. And that does work out to our benefit in that regard. So there's a lot of things going on there. Rather interesting. All right. So that would be a big change if they did that. But, and by the way, I think a big, big change would be in looking at our situation with Mexico. Our situation with Mexico is very upside down in terms of how many goods we import from Mexico. It's because we had a free trade agreement with Mexico. So there a lot of manufacturing left the U.S. and actually set up in Mexico with maquiladoras and corporation and factories and stuff all throughout Mexico. And I think that has worked out very well for Mexico. But they do get a lot of services from the United States. And so that would change our equation with Mexico a great deal as well. So I think that's a fascinating thing. That $56 billion in LNG just has a lot of different ways to look at it. And finally, I'd like to talk a little bit about DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, the thing that is under Elon Musk as a special federal employee with, you know, look, he's got a lot of federal contracts. I have no idea how they're figuring out how, you know, his conflict of interest stuff because he does so much government contracting. It's not the majority of business that he does, but he does a lot of it. So it does make for an interesting thing. Of course, then the question is, how do you get somebody like Elon Musk to work with the federal government on things like government efficiency? You know, I don't think there's any other way, there's a number of folks out there who are, you know, captains of industry, if you will, titans in the commercial sector, that you really can't bring them into government unless you have to make some rather interesting arrangements with some inherent conflict of interest problems that they may have and look at that. And I have no idea how well they're managing that back in Washington, D.C. It's difficult to tell because the rhetoric is so politically charged on that. It is really difficult to say, is that something you think is a conflict of interest or is it actually happening as a conflict of interest? It's not quite clear, and I think it's going to be a long time before we ever really know. Anyway, putting that aside, what is the purpose of DOGE? And, you know, it's the old saying, and I always like this, when you're up to your armpits and alligators, it's tough to remember your original intent was to drain the swamp, okay? They're up to their armpits in a lot of different yapping, biting alligators back there. There's a lot of people, obviously, if you're sending out people out of, you're closing down government offices, you're basically furloughing, firing, whatever, you know, busloads of government employees, you're going to have some acrimony, period. I don't know if there was any really great way of doing major cuts, and I want to just emphasize major cuts in government personnel in the civil service without causing phenomenal acrimony and anger throughout the system. So I just want to put that out there. And I'm not saying what they're doing is doing it great, and I'm not saying what they're doing is doing it absolutely horrible. I'm just saying that inherent to whatever they're doing, you are going to run into a lot of acrimony, regardless of what it is. And now, stuff where DOGE is trying to access, you know, people's personal data on Social Security and stuff like that, that makes me a little concerned because I do have some privacy concerns about that. Who are these guys? Are they vetted? You know, what is their intent? What will happen with that information? Is it being safeguarded, secured? There's a lot of things to think about with that, with a lot of these things. But anyway, I just want to point that out, that I don't think you could do the cuts that are talking about. When you start talking hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars in cuts, that's red meat. And you're gonna draw blood. All right. There will be blood in the water, and there is. All right. So I just gotta say that. But on the other hand, though, I think the desire to reduce waste, fraud, abuse, public corruption in the federal funding is kind of a bipartisan desire. In fact, I'd say it's fairly universal. I don't know anybody out there who is pro-waste, pro-fraud, pro-abuse, or pro-corruption. I'm sure there are exceptions, all right? I have no doubt. But generally speaking, you know, both sides of the aisle would both agree that, you know, these are things that they have to address. And actually, it's interesting, when you listen to most of the speeches, they will always start out saying, look, we all want to reduce waste. We all want to reduce fraud. We all want to get rid of abuse. We all want to get rid of corruption or conflicts of interest, whatever they say. They all say they're for it, all right? So there isn't a big lobby that favors expanding or retaining all of those aforementioned negative terms, if you will. In fact, those terms are pretty much negative. I don't know anybody who thinks of those things as positive in any way. So I just, unless, of course, maybe if you were in organized crime, you go, well, hey, we're into that, you know, but most people think of that as a pretty negative thing. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, what you say, you want to get rid of waste, fraud, and abuse. It's kind of like saying, you know, it's like wishing for good health and great weather. You know, not a lot of people out there, with a few rather mean-spirited folks, would say, I'm wishing you bad health. That doesn't happen very often. Or may you have horrible weather. That's a really rotten thing to say. So I just want to kind of put that out there. You know, the aspiration for those things is generally something that's very supported across the board. All right. Even if people hate Doge, they may hate Elon Musk, they may hate all the folks that he brought in to do this stuff, they would probably agree that the concept, the purpose of Doge is not necessarily a negative thing per se. All right. With all that, I will point out something that I've worked. Look, I've got over four decades working in the government, for the government, with the government, federal, state, local, tribal, territorial, special jurisdictions, and working for the government indirectly with major big honking corporations that have huge government contracts. So I've done this. I've done it throughout the United States. I've done it in foreign countries. And I've been doing this stuff going back over four decades. So in that regard, I think I may have picked up a thing or two in that time. All right. And there are a lot of practices over time that have made government bureaucracy inefficient or wasteful or ineffective. And these practices have been kind of assimilated in many cases into the corporate culture of a lot of government operations. All right. They have kind of become the terrain by which you navigate throughout government. And some of it is counterproductive. I mean, I could tell you stories all day long about the end of the third quarter going into the fourth quarter. And if you have money left in your budget, what you're supposed to do. Bottom line is, I'll give you a hint, you're not supposed to have money left over in your budget. You're not supposed to have money that they take back. That's pretty much almost, it's written in stone in every government organization. Thou shalt not fail to spend all the money allocated by Congress by the end of the fiscal year. All right. So with that said, I just want to kind of throw that out there. That there's a reason why there are things done. And although when you try to clean it up, I don't know if you could go in there and try to do something fast without tossing a lot of babies out with the bathwater. And I think that's one thing Doge is going to have to do, is figure out a baby strainer, if you will, a way to quickly recoup if a baby does go out with the bathwater. And there have been some notable cases where that has happened, and they're a little slow. I mean, I would have liked to have seen this built into their structure a little bit better, a little slow catching this, but there's a lot of times that they have gone in there with, I think, sometimes, you know, with the best of intentions, consistent with what their organization is set to do, but they have certainly tossed out some babies, and then they had to quickly regroup when they realized those babies are pretty important. All right. Now, I've been a public employee in uniform and out of uniform. Not all public employees are lazy. All right. They're not all greedy. They're not all overpaid by any case. And I got to tell you, if you work in government, they're not all anti-MAGA either. All right. That's a misnomer as well. But some are all of the above. Okay. So it's like any other large organization, you know, a large part of our society. All right. The big problem across the board is that the public sector doesn't necessarily have the same pressures on it that you have in the private sector. In the private sector, you have to be more efficient. You have to be, in many cases, much more aggressive in terms of pushing what you're doing. You have to hustle, if you will. That's how you get business, keep business, gain business, whatever. That's how you keep your business afloat. All right. You're forced by necessity to get rid of certain inefficient things, because if you're inefficient and your cost of goods sold is that much higher than the next person, then you're going to lose business over time because you're selling stuff at a higher price that they can get a lower price, and the market has spoken. So that's one of those things. One of the problems I saw, and I saw this particularly in Homeland Security, was that they would take things that were done very efficiently in the private sector. My firm was kind of a victim of this, and they felt that they had to move it into the public sector. I don't know why, except there was a bunch of federal grant money attached to it, and they go, great. And when they did that, you a lot of times the price of whatever they're doing went up 2 to 5 times higher. And I could say that in Homeland Security training specifically, that the price went up a lot. It was the results in one case dealing with counterterrorism. I saw the results literally dropped, corresponding. The price doubled and the results immediately cut in half. It was fairly dramatic. And when I say cut in half, it was the way that they measure the results of the training. And then the other thing, because it was public safety, was also, and this was dealing with terrorism, the number of terrorist attacks that we failed to stop also doubled. So there are huge implications for what happens in these areas. When DOGE is going after things like national security programs and homeland security programs, I think they need to look at those. During the campaign, the Trump organization or Trump campaign talked about FEMA and FEMA grant funds, or FEMA and then federal grant funds, I should say. And I thought that was rather interesting that they zeroed in on that. Those are a couple areas that need certainly a lot of scrutiny. I've worked in that arena for a long time, and I can tell you they do need a lot of scrutiny. But they also got to be careful, because when you're talking about national security, homeland security stuff, if you suspend or shut down or something some of these key programs, you really do have to understand what these programs are. And in some cases, these programs are so unique, there is no way to cleanly replicate all of what they do in the private sector. You could probably replicate a lot of what they do much more efficiently at much lower cost to taxpayers by better incorporation with some of the private sector economies of scale. But there are certain things they need to look at very carefully when they do that across the board. And I think that's something that they need to consider. Also, and I say this very carefully, there's a whole area they have not hit at. These federal agencies, a lot of these federal programs, you know, when you get a check for a lot of these things, that federal money doesn't come to you direct. It goes through a state. And so there's a whole state bureaucracy, which is acting as the instrumentality or administrative agent for that federal agency within that state that gets that money to you. And one case in Homeland Security, under the Obama era, they actually took the authority given to states in that and actually gave them nationwide authority. So literally, California was telling Florida and Texas how they could or could not spend their federal grant money and with whom they could spend it or not spend it. And that was a blank check for some real conflict of interest and corruption issues, because so many of the folks that were doing this in California had private financial ties to some private training organizations, which they kind of lean towards, if you know what I mean, in terms of those decisions. So let me just say there's a lot of things that they need to look at across the board. DOGE needs to be very careful in how it steps in this area, because so many of these things are time sensitive, and we don't want gaps in our capabilities from the intelligence community. We don't want gaps in our capability in terms of national security, like military and other things. We don't want gaps in being able to go out there and track down and catch terrorists before they do a horrible terrorist attack or the next 9/11. We don't want gaps. So some of the things done in other programs are going to have to be very careful when they do that in Homeland Security, National Security. All right. That's a lot of different things. I've covered a lot of information today. Started with terrorists. Started out with my little diatribe on Doge. And so I hope you enjoyed that. Thanks for listening to Strat. And also, please visit stratpodcast.com for other strats if you want to go back to the historical files. And then, of course, you can also go to YouTube channel Hal Kempfer TV to see my regular segments done on various news media like News Nation, Live Now from Fox, and other stations. And then, of course, also occasionally I'll do a little thing like just for the YouTube channel, like three things you need to know about a particular war, conflict, event, whatever it is. Thanks again for joining me and spending some time listening to Strat.